The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I often talk about being with winemaking royalty, and I am. And I think I'm with the greatest winemaking duo in all of Canada. It is Peter Gamble. It is Anne Sperling. And we're here to talk about the On7 Winery. Peter and Anne, thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
Yeah, delighted to be here.
You know what? I'll start with you. Because we're going to talk about the project and about the winery, which is incredible. Incredible Pinot and just ridiculously good Chardonnay. But for people who don't remember, because you were on much, much earlier, one of my first podcasts, I was wondering, Anne, if you could just tell everyone a little bit about all the ridiculous amount of projects you do.
Okay, well, over the years, we've done a number of startups, both in including British Columbia, Ontario, and Nova Scotia. And, you know, generally we work, often we work together with Peter doing the kind of the concept, the overall kind of picture, style, direction, you know, getting to know the ownership in order to, you know, kind of have the right fit. And then my role is generally in the vineyard with what the soil kind of wants to do and the style and direction of the wine. So I guess, you know, Peter really got started in the consulting side in about 2000, and his first major project was Stratus, and then followed up with Ravine locally. And I guess I was doing the startup at Malabar at the time, and then that kind of led me into Southbrook for several years. And then Peter went out to Nova Scotia with Benjamin Bridge, Lightfoot and Wolfville. And then I was out west doing the startup at Sperling Vineyards and Clos du Soleil. And then now we're more focused in Ontario, even though we still have our connections in all of those places. But I guess our latest launch is Dobbin. But during that time, we've been doing the On7 and Lely Stonebridge. And what else have I missed?
How many have you missed there? By yeah, the, but yeah. did you even mention Mendoza? Did I miss that? At some points, it's hard to keep up with all the geography.
Yeah, no, that's true too. We have a tiny vineyard in Mendoza. It's more than 100 years old vines of Malbec. You know, really unique planting of Massal vines and own rooted. So that's been, you know, another kind of interesting and project that's given us a lot of depth and diversity in our winemaking.
Peter, did Anne miss anything?
There were a few small ones. We've consulted to Ice Cellars and to Cloudsley and to a new one called Kirby Estate that hasn't really been released yet.
Ice Cellars, that's pretty close to here, isn't it? Like where they're
very close.
Yeah,
wonderfully close.
Yeah,
a couple kilometers. A beautiful piece of property, growing in size. Some recent plantings and really, really good group.
Yeah, and they do a good Cabernet. They do a good Cabernet. Also, shout out to Stonebrook, the story of the Sauvignon Blanc. I loved. I actually bought a couple bottles of it. And it's nice to see that Lely is back in the hands of much more local winemakers and it coming back to those other years.
Thought that was fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, David and Donna Lely are old friends. And mm-hmm. It was just great that was able to happen. And Faik brought them in order to plant the first vine of the new vines that are being planted on the property. So it was, an excellent time.
Peter, I'll ask this of you. How did you first get into wine? Because obviously you've been doing this for ages. You've consulted all over, like Anne as well. But do you remember your early days? You're like, this is something that needs to be my life.
Yeah, that happened in university. I got interested in wine like in year one at university. Bought a book on wine. Thought it was an absolutely fascinating subject and just continued to devour everything over that sort of 3 or 4 year period. I read essentially everything extant on wine, even, you know, honed up on my very marginal French at the time in order to try and read some more on wine and get a better understanding of it, and ran into a sort of fluke situation where one of the only two product consultants, wine consultants in Ontario at the time. When now they're, I don't know, 150, 180. There were only two, and one of them was in Peterborough when I was going to university.
So I'd interrupt for a quick second, just for the context. What sort of years are we talking about?
So
here?
We're talking late 70s.
Late 70s. Yeah, my God, think about how different the wine scene is in Ontario now versus then.
Unbelievably different. Yeah, so a totally different world. So there were only two product consultants, and so I ended up joining them for the tastings down at the LCBO every second Tuesday morning, which was great and gave me a really rapid education in wine, both good and great.
And what about you, Anne?
Grew up in a vineyard in the Okanagan, and we had a pretty long history starting in the 1920s of growing grapes on our family property. In 1978, my dad planted some of the first Riesling that was being grown in Canada. So we'd have winemakers and viticulturists sort of coming through and coaching on how to grow vinifera and how to grow Riesling. And so, you know, sitting around the kitchen table, listening to all these conversations, I thought, hey, being a winemaker might be pretty cool. So that's kind of how it all started.
Okay, we're gonna bounce around, because I want to ask, how did you guys meet? Do you guys bicker about wine? Is there one wine that Peter loves and Anne hates and Anne loves and Peter hates? Are you always in lockstep when it comes to vinification and viticulture and all of that? But I'm going to hold off on that for a second, because I do like bouncing around. How did you guys get introduced with On 7? What was the story there?
Well, On 7 began with Vittorio looking at getting consultation on a property in Niagara that was located...
And that's, by the way, Vittorio De Stefano.
Exactly.
Yeah, and his wife, Sula.
Yeah, that's right. So Vittorio and Sula own the property, and they were looking for consultation to do it, and they wanted to do something very top-end. So they were talking to a number of us here, just in terms of getting some guidance during those initial sort of stages, and then making some decisions on who would be doing the winemaking. And it was an exciting area for me, because I always felt that there's an awful lot of attention being paid to the bench, and justifiably so. There's fabulous wines on the bench, and I work on some of those projects. And so it's interesting, though. It just, as within Burgundy, you get the differences between the Cote de Beau and the Cote de Nuit, and you get, you know, very big differences between villages. And so I always thought it would be an interesting opportunity to try and do a Chardonnay and a Pinot Noir in a little greater warmth, with a little greater depth. And I had some theories about rootstock in order to try and extract a little bit more out of the terroir in those sort of areas as well. And so that's what really began it. I was quite passionate about it, and Vittorio and Sula thought that, let's go for it, and let's do it at the very top end. And they were prepared to do that. They were, you know, it took us nearly 10 years, and we're still not completed planting a very small 7-acre property in order to get exactly the clones and rootstocks that we wanted. So it's a tremendous amount of detail, and it's been great working with them. So there's
And this, where the grapes are sourced, your Chardonnay and your Pinot Noir, the appellation is Four Mile Creek, correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And the reason I'm doing this, and it's been a theme on this pod, is I'm trying to get listeners and people to realize that Ontario, we have appellations, and the appellations are different. You mentioned the bench. Bench is cooler than Four Mile Creek. Four Mile Creek, you can get more Cabernet Sauvignon because it's warmer. I think it's important to recognize that, because it makes people realize that there is this higher level of quality if you have the right grapes in the right places, much like in Burgundy, the difference between Beaune and Nuit, and we're going to plant this here or that there. So that's kind of why I wanted to get to that. By the way, I'm going to go back to Four Mile Creek in a second. I guess I'm going to go back to a lot in a second. Take us back to those early days. What was 2009 and 10 like when, you know, you're tearing up old vines, putting in new ones, trying to make it organic? I mean, this project was really a start from scratch project.
Yeah, absolutely. Organic right out of the gates. Maybe I'll let Anne address that. She's been involved in viticulture since day one and has led that. So.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the objectives and particularly a direction coming from Vittorio is you know, I like Burgundy, but I also recognize, you know, that certain terroirs can do things better than others, but I want to be sure that we can make, you know, a rich wine every vintage. So in Niagara, you know, we know that Chardonnay is the winner for that, and then Pinot Noir as well, in terms of, you know, the harvest window and kind of all of the ideal conditions to get those wines to their optimum every vintage. So the next thing we did, though, was, you know, and we were in lockstep on this, is that it is farming it organically. You know, not only do they have a home on the property, but also just to gain that complexity and the kind of structure that we're looking for in the wines every vintage. So working with SO4 rootstock, which might seem a bit counterintuitive, in order to lengthen the growing season, get an early start, but also have those vines working through the entire season, whether it's a wet growing year or a dry year, and recognizing that with organics, you're not doing that fast uptake of nutrients. It's got to be a long, slow period. And of course, with a bigger root mass that you get with SO4, you're getting access to more minerals. So we want that mineral composition making its way into the wines.
And you can clearly feel it in the Chardonnays. So this quote I found from you, Peter: from day one, we've had a clean slate to begin with. We weren't in a rush to plant vines. It was slow. It was focused. I'm wondering for both of you, how exciting was it to be working with this clean slate that you could, almost like an artist with just an empty canvas that they could paint however they saw fit?
Yeah, that makes a lot of fun. I mean, one of the things about making wine is that keeps us sort of rejuvenated at this stage is it's nice to be able to do something completely different. The hunt to do a Chardonnay in that rich kind of style was really important to us and a big part of what we wanted to do. Similarly with the Pinot Noir, but that was staged a little bit later. We didn't begin the planning until about 3 years after that.
How'd you guys meet?
We met in Bordeaux, of course, appropriately at Vin Expo at the wine show there. So Anne was part of the BC contingent. I was part of the Ontario contingent. That was the first time we'd ever met.
What do you remember, Anne?
What do I remember? I remember that there were a lot of wines at Vin Expo and a kilometer-long building of booths. And then, you know, I got to hang out with Peter for a few days. So it was pretty fun.
What year approximately was this?
93, yes. Right?
And yes. The reason I'm asking is, what was the reception and the preception of BC and Ontario wine in Bordeaux in the early 1990s?
Just kind of going back a bit.
Yeah.
We'd had, as an industry group, we'd had a lot of discussions starting in about 88 about VQA and how we would form the appellation and whether, you know, Ontario and BC would kind of have a parallel system or whether we'd develop independently. But by that point, by the mid-90s, we were working together to present those VQA regulations to the world and to have them accepted, because at that point they were just within Canada and actually just provincial. But we were working at that point to get international recognition, particularly in the EU. So being at Vin Expo was really important and sort of having that united presentation.
Right.
So we were actually a Wines of Canada booth at that point. So it was, yeah, it was really actually exciting times because, you know, it was having the new regulations, the new standards to work under and to kind of gain the recognition for the quality wines that were being produced was, you know, it was big news at that point.
How much do you guys enjoy, whether it is with On 7 Chardonnays and other projects you've worked on, how often do you enjoy when French people get confused and they drink your wine and they're calling Meursault or Montrachet?
Yeah, no, we see that a lot, and we see it even more regularly now. There's been a recent case, for example, when an agent that I know very well was bringing over a very important exporter of Burgundy. We did a bit of a tasting for him in order to let him try some of the local Chardonnays at the top end. And it was really part of the reason for his visit, especially for coming down into Niagara for a day or two. And so it was really a very, very interesting tasting, where at the end of tasting several Chardonnays, and again, then later in the day, tasting at another winery, we brought him over to Thomas Batchelder's as well and tasted through the wines and said, it's very difficult. It would be very, very difficult to tell these blind from elite Burgundy. And so that was very, very great to hear.
Yeah.
And it's not the first time.
You know, nor would it be the last. So you guys, as you said, you could have gone with this project, with On 7, you could have gone with more New World-y California styles, and that the area was a little bit warmer, and yet you decided to go Pinot and Chard. Is this just strictly because of your love of the varietals? Because you might have, as you said, it might have been easier. So did you guys take the more difficult path with this winery, with this terroir, with those specific grapes?
Definitively not. I think the region is the greatest region outside of the Cote de Beaune, outside of Burgundy, for the production of Burgundian-style Chardonnays. Wine done in that paradigm as opposed to a New World paradigm. I think that the temperatures, the soils, a number of things related to the climate and to our experience with the vines over the past, say, 30 years, that we've seen a movement toward a style of wine that's really very similar to the classic Burgundian paradigm. So I think that, you know, to do it in the vast majority of the climates here, even in a warmer spot, as I mentioned, like on 7, which some might say is a little more suited to a bit more New World style, I think to go to a broader Burgundian style is still the way to go there. So mm-hmm. I think if you're being, you know, true to the soil and to the climate, that you're going to go in that direction. And I think the same is true with Pinot as well.
And I'll start with you, Anne, on this one. We always hear, and if someone goes in and they meet the winemaker and you hear, oh yeah, we do low yields. And everyone nods their head and go, oh, okay, that's good, that's great. But I was wondering if you could sort of put it into context and what this means. So for on 7, it's like 1.5 to 2 tons per acre, which is a very low yield. So I guess two part question. The first, what is the direct connection between low yields and high quality wine?
So from a viticultural standpoint, I like to sort of set it up where the vines have, they basically grow the shoots from the start of the season, usually in May, the early May, and by the middle of June and some years to the July 1st, the canopy is grows and is pretty much set. So you've got at least a meter of leaves, often it's slightly more, and then you move into flowering. So from that moment in the season, those leaves that are there in the canopy are, you know, photosynthesizing. They're capturing the light from that growing season mm-hmm. and channeling that energy into the fruit that's there. So if you've got twice as much fruit, those leaves have to distribute that energy into twice as much of the potential wine. And so you're, you know, right out of the get-go, whatever that crop load is going to be sharing that energy. So if you can focus that into a smaller amount of fruit and still have a balanced vine and still harvest in a normal window with good acidity, then you're going to have more extract. And extract is, you know, what gives the wine the body, the harmony, and the ageability that we're looking for in making a wine like this.
And that also means that's, you know, just very simple. That means the wine is going to be more expensive because all the time and energy is being spent growing all these grapes. And then you go to a lot of these grapes, you're good, but I'm going to throw you to the ground. And it just means you're going to make less wine, but that wine's going to be better quality versus, hey, every grape, hop on into the pool. The wine's not going to be as good, but we get to make more of you, so we don't need to charge as much. Is that? It's a very simplistic way, but I really want to hammer this to people listening, the importance of low yield to good quality, but that also means more expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. All of the operations in the vineyard and, you know, all of the manual operations that we go through are the same or actually even more than, you know, a higher yielding property. So,
right.
so the workload and, you know, particularly the manual labor that goes into it in the vineyard year is extreme.
Peter, can you put this in context? 1.5 to 2 tons per acre, what, say, a larger Napa manufacturer that makes, you know, 20,000 bottles or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, let's go to full out commercial first.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be unusual, for example, in the Central Valley in California, where, you know, less expensive wine is produced, to be able to do more than 10 times that amount. So in the vicinity of 15 to 20 tons an acre.
Yeah.
And you're doing some of that with the sprinkler heads, obviously. So and not only that, but as Anne mentioned, in terms of the labor involved, You know, there are properties there that are, they're proud of the fact, you know, from a commercial production point of view, that their people never need to leave the tractor seat, you know, that all of those operations are being done without, you know, putting any footprints in the vineyard to speak, that everything's done mechanically. So when you're looking at an operation that instead of cropping 15 to 20 tons an acre is cropping, you know, 1.5 to 2 tons an acre, particularly extreme in the case of on seven, then doing instead of zero operations manually per vine, doing somewhere between 40 to 70 manual operations per vine per year. It's just it multiplies the amount involved in terms of the money and in terms of the available product.
And again, this is why, when to anyone out there, don't blink at $50 for a bottle of Ontario wine. Don't blink for 60 or 70, which some of these come in at. These the margins are very small. The 1.5 to 2, I'm gonna stay on yields for a second. Where else in the world does yields like this, these low yields?
I think the greatest examples are the Grand Cru Burgundies, where, and that's, of course, the paradigm, and that's where we come from. Pinot Noir is particularly picky in terms of wanting to be low cropped. So even more so than Cabernet Franc, for example, or even Cabernet Sauvignon, the lower quantities are really important to developing the intensity and the style and the extract and the characteristics that you want in the wine. It's Chardonnay can go a little bit higher than that, so it would be closer to 2 in these kind of extremes, and a little bit higher than the Pinot. But yeah, really, a lot of the greatest wines from the cool climate regions, the ones that people would be, you know, particularly familiar with, could sneak down into those territories. And those would be primarily the Grand Crus in Burgundy and the First Gross and the High Gross in Bordeaux as well.
Yeah, that's some pretty expensive comps.
Yeah, and two tons an acre, just to put it into another way of expressing it, is like 34 hectoliters per hectare.
So basically not what La Crema is doing. And no offense to La Crema, but not what a $35 bottle of La Crema Chardonnay is doing.
Well, you can't afford to produce wine with those kind of quality standards at the lower price points. I mean, it's as simple as that. If you're doing that kind of cropping and you're doing that kind of manual labor, there's just a lot more involved in it. Land prices play a role as well, of course, in some areas are more expensive than others. But there's just so much involved already in terms of the work and the reduction in the crop.
When was the last time you guys bickered about wine?
Well, it was probably yesterday.
Yeah.
What was yesterday?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I can't remember one yesterday, I got to say, but we disagree a lot of times on winemaking style. And so we'll think, sometimes I'll think it should be left out a little bit later, for example, in the vineyard. Sometimes Ann will think we should be bringing it in. Sometimes I'll think we should do, you know, a longer skin soak. Sometimes Ann will think it should be shorter. Usually one of us plays the lead role on any of the given properties we do.
Right.
And Ann will always play the lead on viticulture. I'll sometimes play the lead on the winemaking, and sometimes she will too. And so that avoids a lot of the discussion, because if it's my name attached to it, then I'll be making the decisions as to what happens when, and vice versa.
That's good. That's good teamwork. All right. I'm going to keep on the personal stuff for a second. My girlfriend gets upset when I eat all the chocolate chips. It's one of my favorite snacks. She will hide the bag of chocolate chips from me. I'll always find it. Sorry, Amy. And I'm wondering, do you have a shameful wine that you will hide from your partner, that I really like this wine, and the other one's like, how can you like that? Like, or I mean, is there always full agreement, or is there something that one of you likes more than the other?
Yeah, that's tricky. We both have really broad palates and like an awful lot of wine. You know, we get asked the question a lot about what are our favorite wines. And
by the way, such a hard question to answer.
It is. Yeah. You know, like, we love so many of them and so many different styles. If I covet anything really carefully in the cellar, it's probably great old Grand Cru Burgundies, both red and white, but primarily red.
And but generally those will come out when, you know, when we've got a group.
Yeah.
You know, people especially that appreciate it. So,
oh yeah,
yeah. So there aren't any wines that we don't share, but there's probably some, you know, sort of lighter, crisper, crunchier styles that I'll say, hey, you know, you never bring up that rosé, or you never bring out some of those styles of wines, and it's probably just because we have many to choose from and lots that are at the prime drinking age.
Let's talk about the first wine. As we've been chatting, the two have been poured. I believe, are we starting with the 2020, the Pursuit Chardonnay?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And what's the story behind this wine? Obviously, it was a warmer vintage, but what are some of the things, and I'll start with you. What are some of the things we should know about the 2020 Pursuit Chardonnay from On 7 Winery?
2020, as you mentioned, it was a warm vintage, so maybe a little more challenging from the perspective of the style of Chardonnay, but in the sense that, you know, we want to still capture the freshness that is typical of the Niagara region. And so harvesting was one of our earliest harvests on September 8th, and we did harvest all of the Chardonnay that day.
What's that day like, by the way? If you're doing all of it in one day, when does that day start? When does that day end? How's the body feeling the next day?
So we actually work with a really good vineyard team. I was thinking about that. Got a lot of experience in the region, but when we go to somewhere like On 7, we recognize the workers that have been doing the work all season in the vineyard. And usually there's a few extra hands during harvest, but the day starts and, you know, you've got the team leaders that are kind of going, yeah, it's been a good year and isn't the fruit looking great? And they're excited to be harvesting it too. Generally, in that time of September, we start early at about 7. You know, as long as there's no dew on the grapes, we're picking right away. The vineyard is netted, so everything starts with pulling up the nets and exposing the fruit that's been protected from the voracious birds from that part of the peninsula. And then, you know, we're looking for clean fruit. So being an organic property, sometimes there's some rot to pick out or some berries that have shriveled up or things like that. So we're doing a really thorough vineyard sorting. The fruit goes into boxes that hold about 10 kilos. So it's kind of a tray. So you've got, you know, maybe two or three layers of grapes, but no crushing that happens in the field. And then those boxes go to the winery. We're doing whole cluster pressing and then chilling down the juice. And often in September, especially in 2020, we had some, you know, we have some warm days. So we're trying to get the fruit off as early as possible in the coolness of the day and then getting it into the winery for processing quickly. The harvest takes about half the day. And then by the end of the winery shift, everything is already in the juice stage.
How much relief do you guys feel when the last grape has been picked and everything is in the juice stage?
Yeah, I think it's an important time for us. We see, especially on the On 7 property, it's unusual, as Ann mentioned, to do them all in one day. It's a number of different clones, a little different on the east block than on the west block. And so we're always paying pretty close attention to that. But it's a relief. It's always a relief. And we mentioned when you first came in today that, in fact, we were finished for the day. So
yes, I know you were saying
you for the year.
Maybe.
Hopefully.
Maybe.
It's always a little
fingers crossed. Yeah. So what's the for the first wine? How would you describe it for people, the Pursuit Chardonnay, just nose and palate?
Really, really rich palate. We love the richness on this particular vineyard. The calcareous concentration in the vineyard is really important to the flavor components. You'll notice it's primarily secondary aromatics, so you're getting not just the ripe fruit characteristics of Chardonnay, but you're getting the secondary characteristics from the fermentation, from the secondary fermentation, from the winemaking processes, from the time in barrel, and you're getting those traits that are coming through with some really rich flavors, hinting toward occasionally some sort of, you know, butterscotch notes, hazelnut notes. Reductive sort of traits.
Yeah, it's funny. It is that little bit of reductive, and people get scared about that word, and I don't. I get excited when you get just a little bit of those notes. The hazelnut, absolutely. And you mentioned just the power, certainly on the mid palate, on both wines. The finish lingers on both of them. So and what's the difference between the Pursuit and then we'll talk about the Devotion. But in terms of yield, in terms of treatment, because I know these are two different wines and the characteristics are certainly not the same.
Yeah, so thinking about the relief of harvest, it totally rolls into the excitement of winemaking, which is, you know, kind of the start of the winemaking year. And so from that settled juice, we go to barrels, and we've got a nice selection now of used barrels that have contained this wine in previous vintages. The ferments are wild, so every barrel becomes a very unique lot. And even though generally the malic acid levels are very low from the On7 vineyard, we go through a full malolactic fermentation as well. So it's about 20 months before the wine is even we start thinking about bottling.
Right.
When the time comes for blending, we actually taste through every barrel and make selections in order to select the ones that we think are most appropriate for devotion and pursuit.
And so what are you looking for that when you make you realize, and for people who don't know, the Pursuit Chardonnay is more of the entry level, but ye Lord, saying this is entry level is absolutely ridiculous. This is incredible wine. It will go out, it will go to battle with Premier Cru or, you know, really well-made Village. And then the devotion, sort of the higher level one. So when you are deciding what goes into the Pursuit bottle and what goes into the devotion bottle, what are the factors you're looking for?
I think primarily the richness. There's no question that that's the bigger factor. We're also looking for ageability, you know, very important within the context of this as well. And so we're definitely looking at that as a factor on the devotion.
And on the notes on the devotion, I guess the other one is, what would you say is some of the differences between the Pursuit and the devotion, either on the nose or on the palate?
What I find is that the Pursuit is a little more open when the wine is released. So it's a broader palate with some kind of overt richness in the early years. With the devotion, it starts out a bit tighter. There's some years, but not in 2020, that the new wood component's a little bit higher. 2020, we actually went with about 20% new wood versus 25% on the Pursuit. But we're also looking for a tighter structure. So we're choosing the barrels that just have been like a slightly more reductive tightening up over mm-hmm. that aging in barrel for that, you know, 20 months or so. And that appear to us, you know, at that stage, that will have the greater longevity.
Yeah, and you can, I don't think I've ever used this expression before, but it's just on whites, but there is a brooding characteristic. Like, I don't know how to describe it. It's just a little bit more powerful, not dark spice, because that makes it seem like I'm talking about pepper, or like next thing you know, we're in Koroti, but there is a heavier spice sort of component. The freshness and acidic spine is all there, but you're right, with the devotion, I can feel its presence more around my mouth. I think I'd be excited to see what that 20 tastes like in 7 years from now, like when it's had 10 years in bottle. I think that would be exciting to try as well. No one ever likes to talk about money. The Pursuit is approximately how much?
Approximately $75.
And the devotion?
I'm sorry, the devotion is $75. The Pursuit is in the $50 range.
Yeah.
And it depends on when it's being purchased in relation to the release and that sort of thing.
If these wines had the word Bourgogne on them, how much would they be selling for?
I think it's not unusual to find Burgundies at this quality level, you know, upwards of $200. And you know, that's an extreme because there are some really good buys within the context of Burgundy.
Yeah.
Too. And so there's some Burgundies that you might get, you know, at you know, in the $100 range that you know will also blow your socks off. But I think it's far more normal to see it at you know, in a range up around 200. And at that, even at that, you won't consistently get this sort of quality level.
I know it seems crass sometimes to talk about money, and also just when you're more conservative and this more rooted in old world sensibilities, you don't want to talk about money. But I think it's important for this conversation because you need, and no one's going to buy these wines and drink them on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. You know, this is weekends, this is celebrations, this is anniversaries, birthdays, or, you know, like something, like you're going to open these wines for something a bit more of a moment. And I think it's important to normalize that drinking Niagara, low yielding, hand-picked, organic, like just everything that goes into it, that these wines deserve for people to not blink when they're going to, if you are going to spend $75 on a bottle of white wine, you should not think, oh, well, I can only do that in France or in Italy or in Sonoma, that Niagara deserves that same level of normalcy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, we would completely agree with that. I mean, there's no question about it. It's a large part of what we do is to try and make sure that Niagara winemakers get the opportunity to take absolutely every step possible in the land, in the preparation of the land, in the selection of the vines, in the viticultural detail that's taken, in the winemaking detail, in the purchasing of the best barrels or the best eggs, as the case may be, in the wine style, and to be able to pull out absolutely every stop in order to make fine wine. And one of the examples of that is, you know, we talked earlier about the rootstock, and that rootstock creates a lot of work, because what it does is it creates a little bit more vigor. It's a rootstock that delivers quite a bit to the above ground activity of the vine, and it wants to grow a little more than you really want it to grow. And so you're starting with something that grows an awful lot of fruit, and then you're doing a lot of steps through the year in terms of pruning, in terms of reducing the crop, and then coming in and reducing it again.
That's a lot of work.
And then doing green harvest and doing all of that in order to be able to take, you know, all of the energy from as deep a terroir as you possibly can, and from as deep a rootstock as you can, and translating that into fine wine. So you're actually creating work, and you're creating work with the sole objective of trying to make absolutely the best wine you can. And it's an expensive proposition.
And the rootstock back in the day was hard for you guys to get, wasn't it?
It's hard to get on the best of the vines, because what happened was SO4, because it can deliver volume, is very often used as a vine that you'd use in order to achieve a large quantity of fruit as opposed to the greatest quality. So to use that quality and then reduce it throughout the year to give you a chance of elongating the season, for example, is something that's, you know, it's not normally done with. So when we wanted, you know, the very best of the vines with that rootstock, it was definitely harder to find.
You've made wine, as is Peter, all over, you know, Niagara and Okanagan and Argentina, and I'm probably missing some other places in the world. What were your expectations with On 7 on day one with this just, again, blank slate, just open fields, and you knew there's vines you're going to rip up? What were your expectations on day one? Have they changed now that you've made some of these wines and these vintages and you've been able to taste them?
I think working on a small property sometimes is more challenging, partly because, you know, the theory has to play out in the ultimate wine. And I'm happy to report that we haven't changed our theory. We haven't changed our thinking about the property. But it also means that on a small property, you know, you have to do everything really well in order for it to make a contribution. So we're not looking to declassify, even though that was in the kind of in the early discussions. And we have been able to work with virtually all of the fruit every season. And that does mean that we've made a rosé in 21, and we've made some sparkling that's in sitting in some cages on Tirage. But we've been able to put those grapes into quality wine every vintage.
And by the way, when you guys make rosé or sparkling, it's going to be damn good sparkling and damn good rosé, but it also means maybe a trickier vintage for the Chard or for the Pinot Noir.
Yeah, very much so. We chose to do the rosé for the first time because we didn't feel, first of all, because we didn't feel we could deliver a great Pinot Noir in that particularly cool year. Also importantly, because going through the vineyards in August, even though we'd cropped as low as we had in order to be able to produce a red Pinot, we were noticing some absolutely fabulous flavors as it relates to rosé. Mm-hmm. We kept looking at the acidities, we kept tasting, we were doing analysis of cuvée and thinking, wow, this could make absolutely stunning rosé. And so the decision became, and we phoned Vittoria and Sula and said, we can make good, probably, red, but we can make an absolutely to die for rosé. And it's these opportunities don't come by very often, and it's probably worth taking a run at it, and they agreed.
Let's talk about Pinot for a second. I went to the Instagram account. I'm sure they have someone else responsible, and you two aren't the ones putting all the hashtags. I'll just read it. Our first true Pinot Noir harvest is finally complete. The grapes were ideal. The weather was perfect, and the On 17 was relaxed yet focused. The grapes were sweet, tasting of dark fruit and earth with nice acidity to round the flavor profile. I want to go back to the first couple words. Our first, and then the word true is in quotation. What does that mean? Why was this your first true Pinot Noir?
The first crop of Pinot Noir, we had less than a barrel. So the we fermented in an oak barrel, and then we had to age in smaller vessels after that. And then the next vintage, we did rosé. And so 2023 gave us, we just went to barrel with three full barrels of red Pinot Noir.
What do you think the Pinot Noir program is going to be like in On Seven? We've talked basically just all about Chardonnay. And by the way, either these shards, you could have this with steak. You could, I wouldn't do it with well done, but who has a well done, what monster has a well done steak? This is a shard with finesse, but also you could pair with a red meat. Where is the Pinot Noir program now? Where would you guys like to see it be?
Well, I think we'd like to see it to continue to expand. It's always nice when we get the years that we need to create the, really good Pinot. We're in a good area for it. And so the decision to do the rosé in the 1 year, we think is really, it's abnormal. There might be small percentages of some of the blocks that we could continue to do a rosé with going forward. And we may, of course, get lighter years to permit a rosé. But the target clearly is to do a Pinot in a red style and to do it in a richer red style. So that's very much what we're aiming at. It's what we're aiming at viticulturally. And, that's certainly the target.
How was the 2023 vintage? As when I walked in here, you guys were saying, yep, looks like we're done with ... We'll see. But what was the 2023 vintage like?
I would say that it was a nail biter from week to week. The first part of the season started out dry but cool. So things advanced pretty slowly in the spring. And then through the summer, we had, ridiculous amounts of rainfall, humidity, dampness for many days in a row. Actually, with the smoke from the fires in Quebec and cloudy days, there was a lot of very low light levels. So it was a really tough one to kind of call and understand where the vintage was going to go. In September, we've had through September, October, and now into November, we've had some pretty amazing weather. So warm, dry, sunny weather. Could have been a bit sunnier, I guess, in September, but a big improvement on the season, and this long dry fall has really brought a lot of the varieties into a nice place. So we were able to get one thing that we aim for with Chardonnay and Pinot, and especially in Four Mile Creek at On Seven, is a longer hang time in the fall. So where 2020 was like, geez, these grapes are moving fast, we better get them off in order to get some acidity and freshness in the wine. This year we were able to hang longer. So harvesting, by comparison, over a month later in
that's
the year.
That's crazy, over so, a month later.
Yeah, and and still harvesting with probably our highest acidity from that Chardonnay block ever. Yeah, so it's brought some really interesting and, a totally new kind of circumstance for what we work in.
And high acidity being a very positive thing.
Yeah.
As it relates to
Chardonnay. And not high acidity, but higher acidity, right. Kind of in the window where we think it's optimum.
Yeah, so. Well, I mean, without with low acidity, you're just never going to make quality. Where do you see On Seven? Say the next, 5 years, where would you like to see the growth of this project and of this very small boutique, wonderful winery?
Yeah, I think going from strength to strength, the vineyard we like every year as we see it. We're doing a bit of roguing, taking out vines that that don't meet our quality standards or that are showing any signs of virus or anything. And so that's all part of the process, but it's being done rigorously and religiously. We're very excited about the quality of the fruit that we're seeing coming off and the potential for it going forward. There's still an acre to be a little bit more than an acre to be planted at some point. And we're waiting for the right moments for that and to getting exactly the rootstocks and clones that we want. So I think primarily just a continued focus on a Burgundian style in a slightly sort of warmer context, closer to, Gevrey, if you use, for example,
yep,
the Burgundy model, then, that might be the case in some cooler areas. So that's where we're going.
And Ann, what do you think these wines are going to taste like? And it's so hard to predict. It's like in my job predicting who's going to win the Stanley Cup in September. But where do you think, like for people that buy these wines that cellar them, and we'll just stick with the Chardonnays because that's where you certainly have the more base of knowledge of. Where do you think they'll be in the next 5-7 years?
Well, and the evolution of these wines, what we've been seeing is that the first couple of years after release, so when you know when they're getting into the hands of wine lovers, is that they're quite open. There's still what we call like some baby fat that shows kind of the, you know, the origin, the fruitiness of the vintage. And then sometimes they'll go into like maybe a 2-year phase where they're less expressive. And so that's where some of that baby fat is kind of disappearing. You're kind of in that, you know, maybe teenager stage where it doesn't quite know where it wants to be. And then they start to emerge from that. But there is a sort of a tightening up that happens there in the middle. And then slowly over time, the wine opens up with those tertiary characters. And we've seen that pretty consistently with these on 7 Chardonnays. And so I think, you know, certainly that 7-year window is going to be pretty interesting. And then beyond, you know, I think that particularly the Devotion is going to deliver, you know, a very consistent, you know, slowly aging wine over that period.
Do you guys have your bottle of wine picked for dinner tonight? I'm always curious about
that. No, that usually happens much later.
Okay, I wasn't.
Usually what we bicker about. I've been thinking about dinner for at least 3 hours now, Peter, and I told you what we were going to have. So why haven't you chosen a wine when it's 10 minutes before it's ready?
That's true. That's definitely a frequent occurrence.
That is a fun thing to bicker about. Peter, and thank you guys so much for being a part of this podcast. When I first tried on 7 at the National Club, I don't know, like 6-7 months ago, it knocked my socks off. It always was sort of on the radar. Then I was able to meet Vittorio and Sula recently and go through a bit of a tour. And it's great being with you guys. You're a testament to winemaking, a testament to just the potential and the ceiling and the growth of what we do here in Ontario. And I appreciate you guys taking time and inviting me in your home and being part of the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for coming down. And we really appreciate what you're doing with the show. Very exciting and interesting. So we'll look forward to more.
And everyone out there, just go Google On 7 Winery. You'll find it. Get on the website, on the newsletter, become a member. You might get shut out. There's not a lot of wine. It sells fast. If you can get on it and you can buy it, I recommend. I've already bought a bunch of both of the Chardonnays. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher. Wait, I don't think Stitcher's around anymore. I'm going to keep this all in. On Spotify, Apple, iTunes, you know, wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.